Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 42. On this episode, we are talking about Interstellar. Interstellar is the latest film by Christopher Nolan. Christopher Nolan has brought us films like Memento, Inception, The Prestige, and of course, The Dark Knight Trilogy. Interstellar, however, is probably the most ambitious work that he has done to date. There's a general critical consensus that it doesn't quite live up to the hype, but it is still technically stunning and thought-provoking. So in this episode, we're going to get to talk about storytelling in the Nolanverse, anti-intellectualism, the human condition, and to help us do that, we have some regulars, Griffin Kale, Mark Wingerter, and we have a new guest, Tyler Smith from the More Than One Lesson podcast, and also from the Battleship Pretension podcast. So we have a great discussion. We try to figure out where our place is in the sky and where our place is in the dirt. And so it's only fitting that on episode 42 being the answer to the ultimate question of life, the universe, and everything, that we do end up talking about a movie that deals with the ultimate questions in life, the universe, and everything. So here it is, episode 42, Interstellar and the Best of Mankind. Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless. Have you on the show, because I thought you had a pretty good perspective, you and Josh. But one thing I did want to ask before we totally dive into getting to talk about Interstellar was, you mentioned earlier, like, growing up in the church. Where did you grow up? Because I think, isn't Josh from the East Coast?
Yeah, he's from the East Coast, but he's from North Carolina. So it's a mixture of East Coast and the South.
That's where we're from, in case it wasn't passed on to you. So that's what I was like, man. He understands, but I didn't know about you, because I didn't know where you grew up or what that church environment was like. Because I know that growing up in church means really different things if you grew up in the church, not the South, and then you grew up in the church in other places.
Yeah, I guess the question is, at what point would you say like a person stops growing up, like age 16, as far as like sensibilities and such.
Well, I mean, you get to answer the question any however you see fit, so you can define it in any way that you.
Okay, I'll go ahead and say through age like 18. I'll just go from zero to high school, to finishing high school. So, I lived in Taft, California, for 6 years, which is outside Bakersfield. Then I lived in Ventura, California, which is by Santa Barbara. Then I lived in Denver, Colorado. Then I lived in Nixa, Missouri, and. Then I graduated from Nixa and went and moved to Chicago. I lived a lot of different places. And so, and then in the last 2 or 3 years of high school, that's when I started to have a specifically Southern influence. And that's when I, I'll say this maybe, by that time, my love of film was very firmly established. And so when I arrived there, that's when I had probably the most arguments.
Cool. So, well, I feel like I have so much more context to how and why you think and are interested in doing the things you want. So I appreciate you explaining that, especially in your groggy state.
Oh, it's no problem. I'm waking up. It'll be fine.
So I feel like this podcast could take a while, but we will not let it get that way, because if we're going to talk about a film that is this long,
we can't make it the podcast twice as long.
Yeah. Because it has no shortage of things to talk about. I mean, it is a Nolan film. And just to set the stage, what I typically like to do is, we are going to be talking about Interstellar. Interstellar is
a film by Christopher Nolan. Christopher Nolan is a very popular director now. He's done the Batman things, Memento, The Prestige. He's got quite an impressive list of things to his credit. In this particular one, he wrote it with his brother, Jonathan Nolan, and it stars tons of people that are super recognizable, you know, not just like people that we as film people know, but people that popular culture would recognize. Matthew McConaughey, Anne Hathaway, Michael Caine, John Lithgow, Jessica Chastain, Casey Affleck, and a surprise appearance from Matt Damon.
He came out of that thing and I was like, that's Matt Damon.
Yeah, I was like, my God. I totally didn't know Matt Damon was going to be in this movie. Because, you know, but that goes back to the thing that I have talked about on other shows where once I know I'm going to see a movie, I do everything I can not to learn anything about it. Mm-hmm. So I only watch enough to know that I'm going to see the movie.
I don't even know that they like acknowledged that before the movie was like coming out that Matt Damon was in the movie.
Yeah.
As that happened, I was like, man, I kind of wish that more movies would do that where it would just be like, oh, surprise, he's here.
Well, I said the movies that I've enjoyed this year the most have been movies where I was surprised because something wasn't given away for me. Mm-hmm. Gone Girl was like that, you know, not knowing some of either the people or the situations that was going to be about, things like that. But Interstellar itself, the themes are pretty far reaching. Nolan has talked about, people have talked about how this is his most optimistic film, his most far reaching thematically film that he's made to date. And I don't know if the summation does it a whole lot of justice, but it says, in the near future, Earth has been devastated by drought and famine, causing a scarcity in food and extreme changes in climate. When humanity is facing extinction, a mysterious rip in the space-time continuum is discovered, giving mankind the opportunity to widen its lifespan. A group of explorers must travel beyond our solar system in search of a planet that can sustain life. The crew of the Endurance are required to think bigger and go further than any human in history as they embark on the interstellar voyage into the unknown. And before I ask our opening question, I do want to point out that spoilers are fair game, but I would love to keep them to like a minimum if possible until a bit later, so we can kind of introduce it a little bit.
Okay.
Because I feel like there's two big pieces to this film. Uh-huh. There's the before Matthew McConaughey goes to the space, there's some themes that are going on there, and then there's once he's in space.
Yeah.
And so I would love to focus mostly on the on what him before he leaves first. So with that said, I'm still opening it up to anything.
Okay.
And Tyler, since you're on Skype, you always get to go first.
Okay.
All right. So the first question is, did you enjoy this movie?
I did. I'm sorry, did you want more?
I did want more.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you know, like why? What stuck with you? You know, what were your thoughts coming out of it?
Well, I guess I should lead by saying that I'm not the biggest Christopher Nolan fan. There are people that are just go crazy over him, and I don't begrudge them that. But I think he's an interesting filmmaker, and that he's an odd blend of auteur and mainstream, and there's nothing wrong with mainstream. There's nothing wrong with blockbusters inherently, but his films are usually smarter than most blockbusters, and I would venture to say that they are usually smart, but I don't think they're ever quite as smart as Christopher Nolan and Jonathan Nolan seem to think they are. I feel terrible saying that, because then that means that I'm setting myself up as saying, oh, well, I'm smart and I can. But the thing that bothered me about a movie like, for example, Inception, is that we're dealing with dreams and layers, and it sounds so complex, but then that's the thing. They're making a big summer blockbuster, and that mentality starts to creep into both the writing and the directing of the film. And for a movie about dreams, and I don't know about you guys, but my dreams tend to be very fluid and strange, and there really is not a great deal of logic to them. And so when I went into this movie that was about dreams and took place in layer upon layer of dream, then I don't know. I really expected something very surreal and all that. It's surprisingly straightforward for that premise. And, of course...
You expected more Terry Gilliam than Chris Nolan.
Yeah. I mean, or David Lynch, for example. Like
David Lynch, yeah.
I mean, I wasn't necessarily expecting Mulholland Drive, but a little bit more of that would have been nice. And what's more is they would regularly stop and explain everything for minutes at a time. And I just realized, okay, well, that's probably for... I'm of the opinion that audiences can be smarter than studios think. And they could have... Let's say any 3-minute explanation in Inception could have been taken down to 1 minute or even 30 seconds. And I think the audience would have been able to go. I think people have more malleable minds than one would think. But yeah, and so with Interstellar, and then I thought Dark Knight Rises was fun. I thought it was deeply flawed, but I thought it was fun. And so as a filmmaker, I think he's just he makes big movies that are very fun to watch. He has really good sensibilities that are that tend to be crowd-pleasing. But I've always found him fairly emotionally cold, and I've found him this is going to sound mean. I found him more as a pseudo intellectual filmmaker rather than an actually intellectual filmmaker. And so it's like somebody who looks at a B or a B minus and insists that it's an A. As far as the philosophy of his films and the way that it's communicated. And I remember thinking, like, for example, The Dark Knight, the Joker is the way he's written and the way he's played and the way he's presented. That is a pretty new type of villain for a blockbuster. And there are people that were thinking, man, I've never seen anything like this before. And I remember thinking, well, if you just look a year before, you would see Anton Chigurh in No Country for Old Men. And you would see this exact type of character, and you'd actually see him more in depth than we got the Joker. And so maybe it's not fair of me to talk about Christopher Nolan in that sense, because he does make blockbusters. He does make not popcorn movies, but he makes big, you know, tentpole films. And so I think he needs to, in order to get pretty massive funding for these things, he does need to try to ensure that the largest audience will see it while still trying to explore something that audiences may not be used to. So I do try to cut him slack, but I also, for myself, have a give and take relationship with him. And so with Interstellar, so that's my background with him. I loved Memento. I loved Insomnia. I loved Batman Begins and the Prestige. Dark Knight, which oddly enough is when most people really started to respond to him. Dark Knight was for me when he started to slip just a little bit. And with Interstellar, I remember seeing the initial teaser and just thinking like, hey, all right, I don't care. I'll see it because I'm supposed to, but I don't really care that much. And then the extended trailer with the emotion of an Anne Hathaway and a Matthew McConaughey, and I thought, okay, this isn't the usual cold film that I thought it was going to be. Now I'm intrigued, but I was also sure that I went in with reservations, and within probably 5 minutes, a lot of those reservations went away because I remembered, right, he may not always do stuff that I like, but he is a consummate professional, and he makes movies that are extremely, extremely watchable. And so, and he is kind of, I'm not sure if I say he's a master of his craft, but he has tremendous command of the craft. And all it took was about 5 minutes for me to be, even if I didn't love the movie overall, in the moment he had me and I was completely engaged with what was happening on the screen. So, so I did like Interstellar, but that's the context for me liking it is I had sort of psyched myself out into really looking at it with a detached a remove, and he sucked me in a way that I wasn't necessarily expecting. So I'm sorry, that was a longer explanation than you asked for. So that's the thing. It was either the 2-word explanation or the 5-minute.
is either right. I did or everything.
Yeah.
I enjoy hearing your history of Nolan, and that's nice. I like that background.
I mean, and if you wouldn't have brought it around back there at the end, I'm pretty sure we could have kissed getting Christopher Nolan on this podcast goodbye. But I think you caged it right at the end, being like, but I was drawn in. He's a good guy.
I'm not saying his movies are dumb. You know, I don't think they're dumb movies. And maybe let me put it this way. Perhaps for him, for Jonathan Nolan, Christopher Nolan, maybe the movies are exactly as intelligent as they think they are. But then audiences who see blockbusters and maybe don't see much else, they don't expect that kind of intellectualism from a blockbuster. Mm-hmm. So they're accustomed to Transformers, and again, that's not even to say that the audience is dumb. They just don't see this very often, and so when they do, they think, "Wow, there's really something going on here." But of course, if you watch all movies, then you'll see that this kind of thing is explored pretty regularly, and there's mm-hmm. nothing particular, and probably in a more in-depth way. And so, I'm not calling his films dumb. I'm not calling him dumb. I'm not calling the audience dumb. I'm just saying that because his films are couched in that mainstream blockbuster context, I think that really changes the way people approach them.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. Like, I like the movie, but I liked, you know, I like Chris Nolan. I would say that I used to be like I go see anything Chris Nolan, you know, does just because it's Chris Nolan. Now I'm starting to get to the point, you know, I think where you are, and I think where maybe, I would hope at least, a lot of people are, and that's, we're starting to see, I think some people are like, oh, he's just getting broader, he's just getting better, he's an auteur. I think he's slipping a little bit, and I think it might be partly because of what you're saying with the blockbuster kind of structure that he's kind of seems to be chained to a little bit.
He's definitely a tentpole guy now.
He's a tentpole guy now. I mean, you know, when the Chris Nolan film comes out, it's like the biggest film that's coming out within a few weeks.
Yeah, like case in point, like Man of Steel, they didn't need to add Chris Nolan to that production team, but they were like,
but they did.
From the producer of the Dark Knight trilogy, yeah. And it's like, do you need to say that? Like the fact that they were going to pay him a couple $1 million just to walk in the door and be like,
yeah,
hey Zach, don't do that, do this instead. Oh, okay,
and then yeah, Zack Snyder would go and do it anyway.
That's right. Yeah, he's going to do whatever he wants.
Or at least based on previous evidence, that's certainly what it looks like.
Oh man, yeah. I could do a whole podcast on how much I hate Zack Snyder. But let's,
you know what? He's a remarkably talented filmmaker who settles for the dumbest material. It's weird. We did on Battleship Retention. We did a profile of him, and I'm happy we did because we went in and expecting to just tear into his films, and even though we often did, it's like they're not without merit. They just are. They tend to. Now, those are films that are intellectually lazy, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and he's a visually great guy, but that material just it doesn't hold up, and it doesn't make up for it. But I was really mad they ruined The Watchmen. But anyway, so back to Chris Nolan. you know, I think what I got from this film, and the reason why, when I try to answer a question like, did I like it? I liked it, yes, because it's a really engaging, thrilling kind of visual experience. But as a movie, it's not very good, I don't think, overall. Like, if you had to put a stamp on it. Because mm-hmm. there's so many nuances to it. But I think it's because I feel like... Because I'm a huge fan of The Prestige. Mm-hmm. And The Prestige is all about the cost of what their life is. Like, their livelihood is. They're magicians, but they're obsessed with their work and getting revenge on each other. And the whole movie is just about what happens to their lives and the people that they become because of that. And it's so much about the character, whereas this movie is so much about the idea. It's all about the black hole, the, you know, our place in the stars.
I was certain this was going to be, like, after watching it the second time, I was like, they were going to call this Gravity, and then Gravity got announced. Yeah,
exactly.
Like, they were going to call this Gravity. Yeah. I mean, the amount of times that Gravity was talked about in this movie was just obscene. I was like, do you even know what gravity is? I'm not even sure at this point because you've talked about it like in so many different ways, so many different times.
They use a lot of like established theories, and I wish I had more time to look them up and stuff. But I mean, they're so varied in science. But I think Nolan is getting way too caught up in the idea of his movies, the scale of his movies, and really with this one, the conceit of the movie. More than he's just kind of letting the characters fall by the wayside, which is not what he used to do. I think The Dark Knight was that shift. I think The Dark Knight is kind of the perfect mirror. I think The Dark Knight works, And I think The Dark Knight is a perfect marriage of like huge concepts and character development. The Prestige is more of character development with a really cool concept. And then he starts to just Inception is just all concept. I mean, there's not a whole lot of character there. The Dark Knight Rises was I hate that movie. I mean, it's really fun because it's a Batman movie and it's a cool movie, but like the conceit of that movie is just kills me. And then with Interstellar, I feel like there was a lot of contrived conceit of like who we are and what the world should be and what it's becoming, and then this idea, the whole idea of them with starting the movie off with like that look back historical like
documentary.
It looked like The Greatest Generation.
It's stuff from Ken Burns, the Dust Bowl documentary. A lot of that is from the Ken Burns Dust Bowl documentary.
And starting with that conceit of like our idea and our story is important enough to ultimately be a Ken Burns documentary is just like, okay. I mean, you really have to earn that. I mean, you're setting yourself up to like really work hard to get something, and they just didn't. I mean, the character and the dialogue and the whole love story. I mean, all that bothered me and was kind of just very heavy-handed. I'm sure we'll go into some of that. We can have two different podcasts on this movie, one about the filmmaking, one about the ideas.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as a filmmaking standpoint, I mean, it's visually wonderful. I mean, it's an amazing experience. I really, really enjoyed the experience, but like it was just, I wanted so much more from the people and the story and the... It's just kind of where Christopher Nolan is at this point. I don't know why, but he's getting caught up in the idea, I think.
Yeah.
For the last for the last 6 years, Christopher Nolan, his films have been a fascinating study in the disparity between filmmaking and writing, because the filmmaking is 100% there. It's the writing that is the problem. And again, like some of the concepts are great. The broad concepts are great, usually.
Yeah.
It's in
the script.
It's in the dialogue and the way the characters are conceived. I find myself saying about Christopher Nolan what I so often used to say about M. Night Shyamalan, which is he's a very talented director and he has a real strong visual sense. He just needs to direct somebody else's script at this point. And I'd love to see Christopher Nolan direct a script not by himself or his brother.
Right.
Well, and I think one of the things about Interstellar that is probably going to be most poignant is the fact that it's kind of like what you were saying, Tyler. Even though the themes and the ideas, the character types that this movie deals with, that Nolan films deal with, are seen and probably seen better in other movies, even within the same year.
Mm-hmm.
Like more people are seeing this movie than those films.
Yeah.
So even if this isn't the best way it's done, or the script doesn't quite achieve what we would hope it would, it's still making people have conversations, hopefully, and think about things, hopefully, that they wouldn't otherwise, because they're not going to go see whatever other film is.
His films are
because
great.
It's too small or indie or whatever.
His films are great gateways, because he is a talented filmmaker who is somewhat uncompromising, especially when it comes to concepts. That I feel like people could genuinely watch Interstellar and hear about and maybe they feel fascinated by it, and they go and look into maybe some of the influences and all that, and they would go back and watch Solaris and 2001, and then a movie that is similar to Interstellar that I do like more is Danny Boyle's Sunshine, mm-hmm. which I think is amazing.
I love Sunshine.
I feel like people. I mean, anytime they watch one of his movies, they could watch Inception, they could watch the Dark Knight films, certainly The Prestige, and they could think, man, this is really fascinating. I feel like he is a filmmaker that actually could inspire people to get into film, and that is exciting to me.
Mm-hmm. So, Griffin, where did you fall? I don't think we've hit you yet.
Yeah. Whenever I left the theater, I was like ready to give this like a soft like 8-9. Like I was like, man, I had out of 10. I had a lot of fun watching that movie. I really enjoyed it. And then I like drove the 15 minutes home and I was like, 7, 6? I mean, my thing about it is that if McConaughey is not there, I don't feel any emotion from any of those characters. I think McConaughey and the girl who played
Murph,
the child.
Not Murph. Jessica Chastain.
Yeah, I like her, but yeah, I feel like the girl, Mackenzie Foy, that, like, besides those two people, like the two actors, I didn't feel the emotion because of the script. I felt it because they acted well and because they brought, like, because I've, for the last couple of movies that I've seen him do stuff like this in, McConaughey has been a very, like, a person that I can get behind, like, emotionally acting and, like, serious stuff.
At one point, surprising, not quite so much anymore.
Yeah, not so much anymore. Now it's just, like, I kind of expect him to be given long monologues sitting on a porch or driving in a car across the town. But I think that inherently is what I feel like is a problem with a lot of Nolan stuff, is that I think back on, like, The Prestige, and there was so much of that movie that he was doing a lot of showing, and he was showing you what was happening, and it was, like, really, like, it was, you know, Hans Zimmer, you know, scored and done really well, but then it was, he was just showing you what was happening. And now I think he's gotten to this place where he's like, no, I got to tell you what's happening, because you don't understand. Like, you don't get it. They're going through a black hole. You need to know that they're going through a black hole and there's no communication going out. Why? Because nothing escapes. You just told me that an hour ago that nothing escapes. And so it's one of those things where I'm just like, I get that. You don't have to tell me that again and again and again. You can just do it and show me. And so I think that whenever I look at this movie, I feel like that is my biggest problem with it. And I think because he did so much showing at the end, the motivations of all the characters, I felt like they all had choices and they all chose, for the most part, I felt like a lot of the characters chose the things that didn't match their motivations. And so I felt, we can talk about that more later as we get to the end and we talk about, like, what the endings were like. But I just felt like, for me, I was like, hold on, but your motivation was this. Why did you end up here? And that, at the core of it, is I feel like where we talked about that he doesn't really have, he's emotionally cold. And I'm like, maybe this guy just doesn't understand, like, where characters are supposed to go. And that's, I'm not saying that
Christopher Nolan's a computer.
I'm not saying he's, like, an idiot. I just feel like, I don't think he doesn't understand movies. I'm saying, like, maybe to some degree it's a matter of, like, not, like, wanting to have a twist, wanting to have it be different than what's normal and what's on, like, what's so usual in movies. And so whenever he does that, it's great and it's a cool ending instead of, like, the normal, usual ending. But it's also, like, I don't feel like it had a reason to end that way. And so I think as we get to that, I have a lot of thoughts about characters' motivations and in the movie and where people ended up and where. But, yeah, I think overall I like the movie, but it's one of those movies. I saw it twice because the first time I was like, I need to see it before I don't have time to see it again. And then last night somebody was like, hey, we're going to see Interstellar. I was like, sure, I don't have anything to do. And so, you know, I think with that being said, I won't probably ever see it again. It, like with Inception, I saw it in the theaters a couple times. I'm not going to buy it. I never bought Inception. Every time somebody was like, hey, we're going to watch Inception tonight, I'd be like, I'm going to play That's video great. Games. I'll see you guys later.
So by seeing Interstellar twice, I think it's safe to say that you've actually spent a significant percentage of your life watching Interstellar.
Exactly. That's real. Yep.
You're probably still watching Interstellar. Yeah. You're just not aware.
I'm like 124 years old, right?
Yeah. Because it just sucks you in.
Yeah, it just sucks you in. And then somehow you get put out, like, somewhere outside of Jupiter, right? Yeah,
convenient. You're not actually here. You're just a fifth dimensional being that's sitting beside me.
Oh, everything's getting so complicated. Okay. So the only thing that I would add to all you guys are saying, because it sounds like most of us are on the same page about this, which is pretty encouraging, because it means that none of us are fanboying Christopher Nolan just for the sake of fanboying him. And there is some great stuff to talk about, obviously, and I think we're all admitting that, but there still is some flaws with this. And that's how I would probably describe it. And that's how I've described it so far to people when they've asked me if I liked it. Because I'm like, yes, I do like this film. I definitely think it's kind of worth seeing. But if I had to describe it, I would probably say that it's visually impressive, but it mostly came off as these overtly intense scenes or emotional scenes separated by large gaps of scientific explanation. So you can never really get on board with either, because you're not exactly sure why you're having such long scientific explanation, and the emotional scenes are so kind of just dropped in there, and they're never subtle. They're always like the heaviest thing. Mm-hmm. People were never just like sitting around playing cards.
Yeah.
And you're like, you see in most science fiction movies at the beginning, everyone's just kind of, you know, jerking around and talking and laughing it up. Mm-hmm. You never get any of those scenes. It's always like, we're going to talk now, and this is going to be the most important conversation you have ever had.
Yeah.
You know, there's just never people just doing life. And so it builds us up to those other things.
It's the hardest question to ask. Like the day after I saw it, I was like, oh yeah, I was telling somebody, I went and saw Interstellar. I was like, oh, how was that?
I'm still watching it.
I mean, it's a hard question to ask, you know? I mean, because it's so much melodrama. I mean, that what you're talking about right there is just melodrama. It's just like, we have to have this important conversation because mm-hmm. the cameras are rolling. You know, it's just...
And they never have the important conversations you would think they would have. It's one of the... I referenced Sunshine. That's where my mind went a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. In a number of ways, by the way. I mean, you look plots as... Even the inclusion of the Matt Damon character and what he turns out to be. Not unlike mm-hmm. Sunshine. It's very strange.
Exactly.
But yeah, I mean, that's a film about a handful of people trying to go and save the world. As I was saying that, I wanted to say a handful of people on a leaky boat are going to save the world, which is a line from Mortal Kombat. But anyway,
it's basically the same film,
isn't it? Though, you know, I mean.
It has begun. I'm sorry. I just love
and so
Shao Kahn in that one.
So both films are about the fate of humanity being in the hands of just a couple of people. And in Sunshine, it actually explored the intellectual ramifications of that, but the emotional ramifications of that. Like, what is mm-hmm. the knowledge that they're probably going on a suicide mission. I mean, in this film, you have. They never address, and I feel like they could have addressed that, yeah, you're probably not going to get home. And maybe the character of Cooper, Matthew McConaughey's character, maybe we could have had him like really played up just how in denial he is, and how maybe when you're doing this kind of thing, you have to be in denial to a certain extent personally in order to get it done. You have to tell yourself you'll be back, because if you don't, you might not go there. And they address it sort of when it's revealed that that lies have been told, because otherwise certain things might not happen. It's like, okay, well, you're doing that a little bit, but that's about deceiving other people. With a film like this, there needs to be a fair amount of self-deception. And I feel like those are big conversations that actually get to the heart of character that are still very serious, but that they don't have. And I think it's because, again, I like Memento, I like Insomnia, but even Insomnia was based on previous material. And so I feel like the Nolans, they're not really great at writing characters. They're great at writing character types, which is why they've worked out so well for Batman. But as far as specific characters, they often will have people declare their motivation and then leave it up to the actor. And often the actor will do great things with it, as Matthew McConaughey did. I mean, he is the anchor of this film emotionally and intellectually, I think. And so they cast it right, and good for them. That is a decision that they made. But yeah, it's one of those things that they give him stuff where he makes these big declarative statements. And I guess the fact that he's making those statements should tell us a lot about him, but he never makes the statements that I feel like one would make in that situation. So I'm not even requiring that they sit around and play cards. I mean, the fate of the world is in their hands. And while I think occasionally you would have to do that to stay sane, I feel like it's a missed opportunity, I think.
Yeah, there's no nuance. Everything you were saying, I was like, yep, that's too nuanced for a Christopher Nolan script. At least script. But the funny thing about, you know, all the character problems, even, you know, when you look at something like Inception, I mean, you know, I think the concept is done to an extent where it's so entertaining that you kind of overlook that. But with this one, it was so much about, you know, wanting to save your, even with just focusing on Cooper, wanting to save your daughter and your son, you know, just being a parent and wanting to make them feel safe. You know, it even gets lost in the concept. So it's like, you know, with Inception, it's like it's a whole different kind of setup, you know, with character wise. But Interstellar, you've got this very important character structure that they just don't do enough with, and you would think that the spectacle would be. And visually, the spectacle is enough to kind of say, "Yeah, go see this movie." But even with the all the ideas that they throw out there, there's so many problems with the ideas in itself that makes this film even more flawed. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's like there are so many plot holes and so many just in the same way that they're not nuanced with the characters in this movie. They're not nuanced with the plot or the ideas. Mm-hmm. They're just like, this is just how that works. This is just the way that it was. This is just what we have to go do.
Well, for a movie that I would say, at least from where I'm coming from, is about the importance of emotion, love, the human spirit, it seems to be drastically devoid of those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I think whenever I got done watching that movie, I one of my friends who was like, "Let me know what you think, because I'm pretty sure you're going to not like it. And I want to know what you think." And so I called them and I was like, "So, quick question: the fourth dimension is love?" And their response is, "Yeah." And I was like, "I got none of that in this movie." I mean, I got that. That's what they said. Like, that's what I felt like was like love transcends like all distance, space, and time. And I was like, "Oh, so love is gravity? Gravity's okay." And I felt that, and I was like, "All right, okay, cool." But I think at the same time, I just didn't get the emotion in the movie at all. And I was just like, "Why? Why didn't you take this opportunity?" Like, besides Matthew McConaughey doing he's really good at that after Dallas Buyers Club, doing like the crying while like laughing thing. Mm-hmm. He did that in Dallas Buyers Club. I was like, "Man, you're good at that." Besides like those scenes, I just felt like I don't know that any of these characters feel anything. You know, like, I knew that Anne Hathaway liked this guy, but not because like she didn't really tell
somehow
us that.
Matthew McConaughey picked up on it.
Matthew McConaughey somehow. Who? I was like, "How did he pick up on that?" Yeah. Whenever he asked Tars, I was like, "Who? Like, what character is that?"
Well, I feel like a lot of our character development was supposed to be happening in, like I said, the first. It's not really the first half of the film. It's more like the first third of the film, when they're back. They're still on Earth. Earth that is broken, dusty, dying, mm-hmm. used up. So when we're in this part of the film, I felt like there was a lot of things that were being critiqued. I mm-hmm. thought there was some anti-intellectualism that they were kind of harping on pretty bad. You know, you had the schools not teaching the right things in the textbooks.
Of course not.
You know, no one wanted to fund NASA.
Yeah.
And lots of times in sci-fi or what could be considered post-apocalyptic, which, you know, I think this still qualifies for. Yeah. Even though it's not full-on post-apocalyptic.
It's like mid-apocalyptic.
Yeah, most of them take an idea. Like, hey, this is the trajectory your society is on. This is where it could end up. And that's what they're critiquing. And I felt like this one was almost, in a maybe not even a subtle way, critiquing where we're already at. The criticisms of progress, the criticisms of... I mean, it's not like there's not already schools that are selecting what's in textbooks and not. I mean, like, am I the only person that picked up on that?
Oh, no. I mean, like, and it's really interesting to have such a pessimistic view. It's kind of like in sci-fi, you either have to have this, like, really super pessimistic view of the future, like, we're all going to die post-apocalyptic, or you have to be Gene Roddenberry of Star Trek, like, everything's going to be awesome, and we don't need money, and everybody's going to get along. And so, you know, again, no nuance, and you know, I personally didn't buy the whole, you know, because there was no explanation of like why the dust storms and why the blight. They're just kind of like, well, this is what happens, so this is what we're dealing with.
We make
paying for our sins.
Yeah, we make more cell phones, so now we can't afford to have crops.
And that's I mean, the whole thing with his dad, with the grandfather, and they're sitting on the porch, and he's like, "When I was a kid, like, it felt like a new idea or a new thing was being invented mm-hmm. every day. And we all just like lived for that thing. And I like this better. Like, that's I like dying in a post-apocalyptic world better." Like, I'm like, oh, like, no.
How does that work? How does that happen? We're creating something new every day. You know, we have a brand new cell phone. You know, it's the new hot thing, like, every month. You know, like, what is your explanation to halt, like, the kind of this, you know, our modern industrial revolution that's just kind of just continuing and getting more and more?
Because they're not enough. It's not like they've run out of fuel. It's not like the problem is, right, like, the obvious ones that we've talked about.
Everybody got brain tumors and died early. Or, you know, like, unlike, nothing. I mean, it's just like the world is dying. Okay, why? Because we were progressive. So we need to be progressive to continue and save ourselves.
So, oddly enough, I don't need why. I do enjoy movies that ask why, but about certain things. And I feel like where the film doesn't ask why in some areas is a problem for me. But in that case, I tend to be willing to just go where the movie wants me to go. It's like, all right, there's this thing called the blight. It's poisoning the air and it's killing the crops and creating and changing the weather. Okay, done. Got it. I'm willing to accept it. And then the idea of, it's not even, I wouldn't even say it's criticizing anti-intellectualism. I think it's criticizing a very specific idea that you run across from time to time, which is practicality above all. Now, practicality is important, of course, but, you know, we're sitting here talking on a podcast about movies. Strictly speaking, none of those are necessary to survive, and that's why they changed the, well... Hey, it's important not to have any illusions about what we do.
This is mission critical, guys. Yeah.
And so,
if you're listening to this, this podcast is very critical.
Absolutely. I mean, we're being very critical of Christopher Nolan. And so the thing about the textbook, I mean, I kind of liked it because even they acknowledge that. First off, like when they say that his son should be a farmer, and they say, and he says, well, I mean, he's smarter than that. You guys know that. And they said, yes, that's fine, but we don't need the things that he can do. We need farmers. And it's a neat idea to me because there's what you need, but if you only ever focused on what you need right now, then nothing would get done. Or at least there is no creativity. There's no room for creativity. There's no room for exploration. Mm-hmm. There's no room for progress. And so I do feel like the film is those moments are a critique of a strain of thought that you run across now, which is we don't have time for that. We don't have time for flights of fancy. We don't have the money for NASA. Mm-hmm. We just need to focus on... you know, we need to focus on the things here, the things that are, we need to keep our feet on the ground quite literally and look at the very practical real world problems.
I think they draw that strain out pretty well.
I like that they did it.
Right. And I'm with, you know, I can roll with a movie without a whole lot of why. I think the big problem was like the why of this, why couldn't we just fix the Earth, is the entire impetus of the movie.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the strain of, like, you know, we're only focusing on what we need is really, I think, done well in this movie because, you know, the first visual that we see is the bookshelf, and the bookshelf has dust on it. I don't think they chose dust as just kind of just whatever. We chose our apocalyptic thing. You know, dust represents, you know, we've forgotten about something.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the first thing we see is the dust kind of falling off the bookshelf onto the spaceship, and, it looks like we've forgotten something. And then, you know, the whole idea that we're looking at our place in the dirt, we're looking down at our feet, we're just looking at what we need right now, and they're making that commentary of... if we only did that, we'd have no progress. And then, you know, you find out in the end, you know, the elder Dr. Brand was focusing only what he thought we needed, and so he ignored the actual solution that, you know, Murphy, the older Murphy, finally uses to kind of save humanity in a certain way. So, which does open up a big plot hole. But,
and you know, sorry, just to make a quick point, because I sort of just thought of this. and then it compounds that idea with the Matt Damon character and what he's always talking about, how the survival instinct is the most powerful instinct. And so he's operating on the idea of doing what is necessary for plan B to work and for the survival of the species. So he's talking about the survival instinct there, but he's also talking about his own survival instinct and how, yes, when you're only ever focusing on the bare minimum of what you need to survive, you can actually turn into something of a monster, as his character has. Whereas, you know, you start to lack it's odd, in trying to preserve humanity, he loses his humanity because right. that's the only thing he's focused on, as opposed to these other characters who say, yes, of course survival is important, but we need to know why we're even worth, why it's worth us surviving, why we as humans are worth preserving. They never really have that conversation, incidentally. That's something I had to get, or I had to arrive there on my own. But but yeah, and so that idea of preserve of criticizing only the survival instinct. I don't know. I have problems with the Matt Damon character from a structure standpoint. Thematically, I'm completely on board with him because the way these two guys, and that's why I thought it was important for them to cast a movie star in that part, because then you have two movie stars out on a desolate planet alone, each of them equal in stature in our minds, and then you have them fighting because they represent two very different mentalities.
Yeah, and I thought Matt Damon was actually a good choice. I mean, even though I wasn't expecting it, and I'm not totally on with his character. You know, I am thematically, like you're saying. But when Matt Damon appears, it's like, oh, hero.
Yeah.
You automatically think somebody you trust.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that was a really good, because he's just a very particular face, and that was good to juxtapose him. Matt Damon likes to do that, by the way. He likes to be like, yeah, I'm the hero, but in this movie, I'm like a really bad guy.
And he's really like, good at it. Like, The Departed. I thought his performance was like the unsung hero of The Departed. Everybody talked about DiCaprio, Nicholson, Wahlberg, and I thought, no, the real heavy lifting is the guy who is the weasel. And
speaking my language, man. Heat it up. Let's talk more about The Departed. What do you think about Casino, man?
I actually don't like The Departed that much, and Casino, no, thank you. But anyway, we can move on. I apologize.
Dang it.
Oops. Well, no. Well, that's why I wanted to get to Dr. Mann's character, kind of a surprise turn in the movie once they've gone through the wormhole. And just in case, like I said, anyone was listening, think there wouldn't be spoilers, we're getting to the point where we're going to spoil something eventually. Mm-hmm. So keep that in mind as you listen. It wasn't until I started really reflecting on the movie that I realized there were a couple things they did with Matt Damon's character. And it's one of those situations where I'm like, how much pre-thought did they put into this? Or is it just really coincidental that I'm seeing these things happen? Because his name is Dr. Mann.
Yeah, that's pretty obvious.
So he's Dr. Mann, and all leading up to it, we are all the discussions between Amelia Brand and Cooper are like, Dr. Mann was the best of us. He is the best of humankind. He is the best. We get bludgeoned over the head with how he is the best. If it wasn't for him, we would have never started this. If it wasn't for him, we would never explore. He's basically described as everything positive about humanity. And so we take in the encapsulation of a man, Dr. Mann, and put him on a new planet, and he's actually faced with self-destruction or self-extinction. And we see that when we go to the stars, we're not leaving behind the bad parts of humanity, even in the best of us.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, we have him turn on the crew. Mm-hmm. And basically, he's carrying evil with us. And it's interesting, like I said, again, in a movie that's supposed to be about love and the human spirit and stuff like that, that they're acknowledging the fact that wherever humanity goes, we're taking the best of us, but we're also taking the worst of us.
Yeah.
And we can't escape that, no matter how many wormholes we go through, no matter how much gravity there is, how much time, whatever dimensions we live in, which actually makes the ending problematic to me.
Mm-hmm.
Because to me, it says that at some point we're going to evolve
mm-hmm.
past fear and hatred and bitterness.
And that was my thing about the whole, like, I mean, is it me or did the space station feel utopian? I felt like that was supposed to feel utopian.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, because it was like this beautiful white, he wakes up to this beautiful white room.
Oh, at the end.
Yeah, yeah. And then he looks out the window and they're playing baseball and they like they break a window and they're just like, ha ha ha, it's cool. We're not having to run home from our parents.
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing wrong. And then he goes to see his daughter. All the families just gathered together to be with her. Like, why wouldn't somebody not show up? Like, surely somebody doesn't show up for that. And then, like, we just have planes coming in and out and everything's just clean. And that's, I like, so if where man goes badness follows, why at the end is it still utopian? Like, why at the end is it still perfect in every way?
Well, that, I mean...
Well, that's a Star Trek, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's that's what I'm saying. It's kind of like they end up in Star Trek land, you know, as far as the idea of humanity. Like, one woman kind of rallies humanity to be this utopia. I mean, I definitely got that, because it's so euphoric when he's sitting there on the porch and... You know, I mean, I love that he did say, I don't like sitting here pretending like nothing ever happened, yeah. You mm-hmm. know, which was great. But I mean, if you want to start talking about problems,
what are we talking
about? Problems?
I don't want to talk about problems.
Problems. I mean, the ending is super problematic, because if you don't want to talk about problems, we don't have to. But I mean, the ending unravels the entire movie.
Well, like you said, from a cinematic point of view, I don't necessarily want to talk about problems. From a thematic point of view,
right?
How does the movie either lie about its own conceit, or what does it tell us about what it thinks about humanity, and is it consistent? That's what I'm interested in,
mm-hmm.
Because that's what to me is problematic. Well, it's awesome, and I wonder how much of it they planned with Dr. Mann's character, but how much of it do they basically renege on themselves with the ending?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so okay, so you're saying that you not only believe what Cooper says earlier in the movie when he's like, "Oh, we will find a way, Professor."
Yeah,
we always have. Yeah, I don't know. He's like George Bush.
I didn't know Dana Carvey was in this movie doing George Bush impression.
You know, so he's doing this.
Will Ferrell doing George Bush doing.
Yeah, doing someone else. So you know. Do you honestly believe, does Christopher Nolan and Jonathan Nolan, do they truly believe that humanity will find a way? What's their proof of this, and how do they reconcile two worlds? One in which the humanity is capable of amazing things, but conceding that humanity is also capable of terrible and evil things, but assuming that we can evolve out of that? Mm-hmm. Like, at some point we just, like, a generation is born and suddenly they're not evil, and they evolve towards a, you know, a fourth dimension, fifth dimension creature. But where does love fit in all that? Is love the fifth dimension? Like I said, there are problems, but I'm wondering where they're taking it thematically.
Well, it's interesting that, you know, when we have a culture that is set up in this movie that has thrown out technology for the most part. They're anti-technology because of what it has quote-unquote done to the world, that they end up on a giant space station in the end. I mean,
yeah.
You know, they end up, you know, having to embrace technology. And what is the impetus of that? You know, we have the elder Dr. Brand with this idea that he is going to lie apparently about everything, which doesn't totally work in the movie. And I didn't necessarily... Did y'all buy his lie? You know, because it just was kind of convenient. Like, oh, he's lying all the time.
I didn't think he had any lines besides that poem.
Yeah, well, it's true.
I thought that's all he was saying.
Yeah, that's right.
And you're saying, did I buy his character as, like, a character who was going to lie about this?
No. Did you buy, after they had set up everything, once they revealed that he was lying about, you know, having...
Solved it years ago.
Yeah, like, once he never intended to do Plan A, did you completely buy that? Because I didn't, because...
No.
There's one line in the movie where he says, I don't know what I'm more afraid of, them failing or them not coming back or whatever he said.
Yeah, or Mina... them not coming back, or them coming back and us not having solved the
thing. Solved the problem. And it's like, don't give us that and then have him be a liar. But it's just interesting that, you know, this idea of, like, realism is looked at in a pessimistic view. And, you know, when we embrace what we have and kind of use its potential, it can save us, I think is kind of the message behind it all. I don't think it's consistent, if that's, you know, that's kind of one part of your question. But I think that's the point they're trying to go for, that they got there imperfectly.
And I do feel like, and I mentioned it earlier, and now that we are talking more about it, I think I feel it even stronger, that the one question they should have asked, and I think it would have absolutely fit into a film like this, is why are we worth preserving?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they even asked that question in Mars Attacks. You know?
Yeah. Well, and inherently, that's a post-apocalyptic film question.
Exactly.
Well, we just asked that question when we reviewed Cabin in the Woods.
Right. Because
that's what Cabin in the Woods asks at the end.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's the thing, is especially when faced with the best of us being so treacherous, and my own father, the man who had the most hope, was shown to actually have none, and just lied to us. Just deceit and treachery, and the idea of feeling you have to trick people to get them to do a good thing. It seems like, frankly, I feel like you could have put that question in the character of Amelia, because she's not given a whole lot to do.
Nope.
But you could have had, but the idea of her own father lying to her and having so much faith in Dr. Mann, and then realizing, what do we, if this is what it takes to survive, why is it even worth surviving? Especially when she also believes in love so fervently, that this seems to run counter to love. And so I feel like they had an opportunity there. I mean, they've already got a character named Dr. Mann. So clearly they're willing to explore the nature of humanity and what that is. But I felt like if you're going to have, and this is what I'm talking about, I'm not opposed to them having big, important conversations. I just don't think they're having the right ones.
No, I would agree, because I feel like when they do try to hit on something, like I said, they either talk about the wrong thing, or they don't talk about it to its conclusion.
Yeah.
Because at the beginning, you know, the movie starts off with Cooper basically chastising Murph for not being scientific.
Yeah.
You know, facts. You know, I need you to use a scientific method. I need you to be calculated. I need you to really, you know, don't come to this with your feelings, you know? And then we move through, and there's this shift in Cooper to a certain degree, because, you know, his worldview has suddenly changed. Quite suddenly. And you know, so we get this speech from Amelia about love and how love is, you know, possibly one of the greatest things in the entire world. And it almost seems like, well, which one do you think it is? Because in my experience, I find that love is very problematic evolutionary.
Oh, yeah.
From an evolutionary point of view, I feel like love is often very counter-evolutionary.
It is very counter,
people
yeah.
running back into burned buildings, people jumping in front of bullets for other people. Mm-hmm. Heck, even people like just being mildly irritated on behalf of someone else, like has no purpose in continuing the species at large. Yet they're trying to say that love, in fact, is like the next evolutionary step, and I'm like, Well, let's talk about that for a second.
Mm-hmm.
Like what is that making, like what is that having us do? And I don't feel like they ever have that conversation.
Hey,
like how is it?
I just had a thought. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
No, make it. No, you were so emphatic that I want to know what this thought is more than anything right now.
Because you're bringing up evolution, and evolution, basically the idea of it is that where we are now is the highest we've ever been. Like it's the, one could say the best we've ever been. And so there is a character.
We're the best around.
We're the best ones around. And there is a character named Dr. Mann, of course, who is described as the best of us. He is obsessed with survival and self-preservation. So evolutionarily, he's the one that actually makes the most sense. Here's where my enthusiasm came from. In the history of Christopher Nolan, there has been another character that has been described as the best of us. Do you know who he is?
Harvey Dent.
Batman.
And how
Harvey Dent. That's
and
right,
how yeah. does he turn out?
Yeah.
Not great.
Two-Face.
It is, yeah. He is the, yeah, I mean, he's the guy,
really
he's the
yeah,
guy
yeah,
who fails. Batman is the guy who is not only
the worst of us.
Well, just he's not only the guy who cannot operate in a legit way, but he's the guy who needs to be chased. He's the guy who needs to be demonized for any real progress to be made. He is, one could say, regressive in some ways compared to Harvey Dent. And so if you look at...
Matthew McConaughey is Batman.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah, he is. That's what I'm saying.
So I don't know, just... That idea, when you brought in the idea of evolution and how love runs counter to that, and this is a film that argues that love will keep us together, then that got me thinking about what the nature of evolution is and a t-shirt I happened to see yesterday when I was at Disneyland. Somebody was wearing a shirt that said, "This is the oldest I've ever been." And and so thinking of that t-shirt, thinking of evolution, thinking of the best of us, it's okay, this is the best we've ever been. That is how Dr. Man is described. So we should probably ascribe some significance to that, that at our best, we are very cutthroat, obsessed only with survival, and maybe we should stop focusing on the best and being our absolute best, and we should focus instead on things that don't make a great deal of sense, things that don't make a great deal, as you said, of evolutionary sense. So I'm sorry, and once I realized that Batman described Harvey Dent as that, I thought, oh, hang on now.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting that Harvey Dent, that him being the best of us was his inherent flaw.
Yeah.
Because his, when he lost something that was close to him, albeit you could say because of love, you know, he loved and love turned him, because love is, as we were saying, kind of counter to evolution. He snapped to, he thinking the best of us was, I'm going to rid the world of,
yeah,
of people who don't belong. And, you know, so that's one way to kind of take that. And that's, you know, this movie kind of looks at that in this, in a similar way with Matt Damon's character, in a similar way with Batman, with Matthew McConaughey, of that. We have scorned technology. We've scorned NASA because of what it has produced and not what it could still produce. And, you know, kind of let our heroes, rot with the blight in the field, you know? So, you know, again, is it consistent? I don't know, but you know, that is where they're headed. I didn't buy the whole love story at all. I mean, this whole thing being about love, it's more about survival and a parental love than it is about love in general.
It's even an oddly parental love,
right,
in that way, because it's something where, well, not only does he bounces to save humanity, mm-hmm, like he leaves his children to, mm-hmm, save humanity,
yeah.
But whenever he has the opportunity at the end of the movie to be with his child, he's like, hey, I'm going to go chase after this girl that not only am I not convinced if I love her, you guys as the audience aren't convinced that I love her. Like, I don't know why he...
Well, she's just alone. She just needs some TLC.
I don't know, but I don't understand. But she's about to grow a bunch of babies inside of her. So why does she, you know, why is she worried about TLC? I mean, there's so much about that whole, like, him leaving his daughter, who he, like, worked so hard to get back to. Like, he was all about plan A, and then on the switch, she says, parents should have to watch their kid die, and he's like, all right, plan B it is then.
Yeah.
And that I didn't buy. I didn't buy that at all. And so it's like, okay, well, maybe he's going for plan B because of Dr. Brand, and then they show you that whole scene where he, like, touches her hand, and he's the giving her the handshake and all that stuff, and I'm like, that doesn't mean that he loves her. Like, that doesn't mean they have a relationship and, like, past their arguments that they had. And that's where I just don't buy the love in this movie.
Well, I don't necessarily think it had to be, like, was it Eros? Or Eros? You know, it didn't have to be, like, romantic love. It was love and respect. You just don't want to be a person to be alone. Because you saw what happened to Dr. Mann when he was alone for a long time. And which just, I think, says a whole lot about What would happen to humankind, well, cut off from
what I got community. From that whole scene and that whole thing. I mean, I thought it was a little weak that he just kind of said hey to his daughter, you know, mm-hmm, even though she was old and kind of dying and that kind of thing. I mean, that he was just like, okay,
that's evolution, man.
See ya. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, I didn't necessarily enjoy that part of it, but what I got from that was she knew where he belonged, and she knew that he belonged kind of in the stars, you know, in the air as a pilot flying, and you know. They had somebody that was out there that sort of needed to be saved, you know, and needed to be kind of helped back to
greater purpose.
Yes, whatever. So, I mean, she kind of let him go was kind of that point for me. But, you know, just the idea. I mean, you know, it's interesting that the gravitational pull of love is in this movie. You know, we have this idea that, you know, she was drawn to the planet of somebody that she loved, and you know, McConaughey kind of, you know, said, well, you know, maybe that's your flaw, and you know, he recognized that as a flaw at one point, and then ends up seeing that, you know, maybe love's gravitational pull is what saves us in the end, and that kind of thing. But it still just was kind of like, again, this whole movie was just about the idea, the spectacle, and you know, which is cool, but you know, thematically, nothing is really that consistent. So. Yeah.
You know,
I feel like I'm sorry. Go ahead, Tyler.
The thing I'll say this. There's a lot to talk about in regards to this film, and thus making it at least a little bit worthwhile for the viewer to see, because it means you're going to have conversations with people, even if the conversation winds up like it is here with us saying the film's inconsistent here, or maybe it's, you know, but we are talking about what the film is saying, and so that's a good thing. And so I just wanted to say that before I say the actual thing I wanted to say. This is a film. Okay, so speaking in terms of, what is it? We'll find a way, we always have. And then the idea of the best of us and all that sort of thing. It's so interesting how much, but also like, oh, well, we also ruined the Earth in the reality of this film, but we'll find a way. And it's not about this. This is a byproduct. This is something I thought about that I don't think the film is thinking about. It's just the inherent arrogance thinking that humanity is just great, is just awesome. Because it's worthwhile, of course, but to say, we figured it out, we'll figure something out, we always have, and then feeling as though, like, okay, well, we've learned from the past. We've got it now. We've got it all figured out, as if you're not going to make mistakes now and you're not going to make mistakes in the future. And that's the thing is, and then of course, conveniently enough, the they in the film, the people that are, or aliens or beings that are helping us turn out to be us once we have evolved to the point of basic perfection, which conveniently enough, we don't see. All we see is people that are flawed. And because part of me is like, I really would have liked to see somebody's conception of a perfect person who doesn't make mistakes and all that sort of thing. And that's the thing is, this is a film. Okay, years ago there was a movie called Contact, which was not very good, with Jodie Foster and everybody else in Hollywood. And it's, again, not that good of a movie, but it acknowledges. Oh, hey, and Matthew McConaughey's in it, playing like a reverend, and that's a film sort of about the seeming disparity between science and faith and that sort of thing. And so, there's all these wormholes and stuff. I don't think they're called that, portals, whatever you want to call them, in space. And when someone says, "Well, who put them there?" and they say, "Nobody." Nobody knows. And incidentally, the Jodie Foster character, when she travels through one of these things, she winds up seeing a representation of her father. So there's that father-daughter thing again. But anyway, but at least that said, nobody knows who put these here. Whereas this is a film that says, we did. We are, you know, I will quote a line from, I believe, President Obama's inaugural speech. We are the change we've been waiting for. and... It's a film. This is a film that so desperately wants God, but will not engage with that idea.
Yeah,
I mean, basically, it's like, okay, so time is a thing that doesn't, that these beings are, they are not limited by the idea of time. They can do whatever. It's a physical representation. They can walk to 50 years ago or 50 years in the future and do whatever it is they need to do. Well, that's God that you're talking about. And so it's just so interesting. Yeah. And science fiction, there is not – science fiction often will contemplate the spiritual. And this is a film that just has a – it refuses to do so, even though I think it is without realizing it.
Well, I think it almost don't you feel like they try to explain away God and to kind of say that these extra dimensional beings that ultimately save us and care for us enough to open a black hole for us that we don't end up actually needing, is us. We are, humanity is humanity's savior.
So recently when I went to the Faith and Film Symposium down in Baylor, basically my entire piece of our group's presentation was the supernatural or the lack thereof in sci-fi. And when I'm watching this film, Laura, my wife, leans over and says, "Isn't this the entire thing that you just talked about?" Because it was when they're starting to explain supernatural away. Supernatural can be anywhere in sci-fi, but it can never be supernatural.
Right.
Which is unfortunate, because it makes this conflict that says there can't be this otherworldly realm in a genre that is full of otherworldly realms.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, we always end up explaining the supernatural in a way that we can understand, which thus makes it not supernatural.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really sad to me, because, like I said, in this one, basically with Tyler, what you were saying is it was basically screaming for God.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was basically screaming to try to explain that. And I felt like it would have been so much better. From the very first of the movie, when she said she had a ghost, I was like, oh no. Because I was like, well, I had a feeling that it was going to be Matthew McConaughey somehow, based on how they set it up. And once he started going to that thing, I was like, well, he's going to say that there's none. He's going to say that there are no beings, we're the beings somehow, or Matthew McConaughey becomes the being. I wasn't sure at that point. And it stinks, because I think it's incredibly unhopeful to me, based on what they show of humanity, to think that we ultimately are going to be our only hope. Because I love this Neil deGrasse Tyson, because he did a whole bunch of tweets on the science behind this, but something that wasn't necessarily scientific, but it was definitely a sociological observance of what happened in the film. He said, on another planet, around another star, in another part of the galaxy, two guys get in a fist fight.
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing new under the sun. You know, people think we're going to get to this place where everything's perfect and everything's awesome, and we're all, you know, super great beings of light that are living five dimensions. But I think this is why I think the movie's lying about itself, because it keeps saying we can do this, but it keeps showing that we can't.
And
because
And that's the other thing, is it's a film in which it's about like humanity breaking through and doing all these amazing things. He says it's us. He doesn't actually know that.
Yeah.
There's no way he can actually know that.
There's no way to know.
He never sees it. We never see it. He is expressing tremendous faith in the idea he just thought. So I don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think we as people try to take the supernatural and we get it mixed up with like the spectacular.
Yeah.
You know, supernatural is only what is possible beyond the natural realm, and things like that. You know, we tend to want to explain it away as something very simple and take something very spectacular and kind of try to dumb it down to say that that's not possible, but these things are. It's still supernatural.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, it the idea for some people, the divide of religion and the divide of the supernatural versus, like, you know, just very practical humanism and that kind of thing, is not as far as they think it is. But they think it's this, you know, supernatural is this huge leap of faith, and it's not. In most ways, it's not. But you know, this is what we have with this film, trying to explain, you know, what could the supernatural beings be? What could all of this amount to? And so, you know, for me, it's not that, you know, as a Christian, you know, it's not that much of a leap, because it's something I study and something I you know care a lot about. But you know, we have this idea of like what's out there in the stars and what's out there that we need. And I think a lot of, you know, Christians would say, well, we, you know, all we need is God, and looking out to the stars. I has always felt, you know, not for me, but for what I've gotten from other people in the church and in Christianity, looking out to the stars is almost like against the rules.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, well, there's nothing else out there. We don't need to know what's out there because we have God. And I think, you know, how do you guys feel about that? You know, being, I know it's a very, very big, broad question, and we are kind of running out of time, but you know, to me, looking at a film like this, where it makes a very bold attempt, which is what is really, really great about this movie, is its broad reach and its attempt at ambition and stuff like that. I feel like we don't get a lot of that in our, you know, culture in general, but also especially not in the church, to say that there could be more out there. I mean, I don't know if there is. I have no idea, but there could be, and that's okay. I mean, just to kind of put a little end stamp on like the kind of theology part of all of this. You know, how do you guys feel about that kind of idea of like looking out into the stars, and as a Christian, as having a very specific belief and specific faith?
We just landed a probe on a comet, right?
Right, which is awesome.
I mean, I personally, this is why I wish Christopher Nolan would direct some of these like 5 minute, 6 minute inspirational videos with Neil deGrasse Tyson talking in the background about how much we need space mm-hmm. and exploration, and how I do believe some of the times that humanity is at its best is when we have a common mission. And I would much rather that common mission be, let's get to Mars mm-hmm. or let's see what's out there, than mm-hmm. we all hate this certain group of people. Let's all agree that we need to bomb them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I wish our common mission was all, you know, a positive, you know, exploration of, I mean, it's God's creation. Mm-hmm. If there are 13 million zillion galaxies out there, I mean, I have a belief that God created them, and until something comes along and tell, you know, proves otherwise. Mm-hmm. And I would love to see them. I mean, I imagine how much beauty and awesomeness I see on this planet, and I imagine that that's only scratching the surface mm-hmm. in the imagination of an infinite creator.
Yeah.
So, you know, I would love us to give NASA its penny or whatever we're supposed to give it.
Yeah.
I mean, so we can explore.
And that's what I enjoyed about this movie, just the idea that it reached so broadly mm-hmm. and, you know, it dared to say what could be in a black hole. I mean, mm-hmm. as kind of conceptually conceited as it was at times, it's still, that's interesting to me, and that's broad enough and cool enough to explore. And you know, despite all the flaws of the movie, that's what did it well. Mm. You know, what it did well.
You know, I find myself feel. I agree with you, but I also find myself agreeing with not necessarily the opposite, but the other view, which is, of course, we should be thinking in terms of the broad and think about like the vast expanse of space and God's creation and trying to understand it and trying to explore it and appreciate it. I absolutely agree with that. You know, it's that idea of, I don't remember the exact line. If I look it up right now, I can probably see it on IMDb, but where Matthew McConaughey says like, we spent so much time, we used to, we used to look up at the sky and wonder at our place in the stars. Now we just look down and worry about our place in the dirt. And in my, and I look at that and I think, well, we can do both. We actually can do both. You, mm-hmm. we need people to wonder about our place in the stars and explore that. But we also need people to look at to worry about our place in the dirt, because not everybody can go to the stars. Some people do not have the ability to feed themselves. And so we need to focus on that as well. So while I think, of course, you know, thinking about it into the way God thinks about it, which is thinking about everything and one thing all at once, you know, loving humanity, but also loving a single human. And so I feel like it's important. I think it is important to explore. I think it's important to have a deeper appreciation for these things. But if that winds up getting in the way of like the person who's directly in your life, who has a need that you can absolutely provide for one way or another, then I think that's when that can become a problem. But I think both are needed, not one or the other.
No, I think that's really good.
Mm-hmm.
And not to do a drastic shift, but we are, like I said, we are running pretty long. And so I don't want to keep everyone too...
Yeah, I guess.
...long. I mean, like I said, this needs to be slightly shorter than the actual Interstellar movie itself.
Yeah, slightly. So,
the longest episode I ever recorded was 3 hours and 50 minutes, like 50 minutes,
really?
Of Battleship Pretension, in which we talked about the year 1999. So anything less than that, and I'm
cool. You're still good.
You're good.
Well, okay. So all we're gonna do is shift a little bit because we're gonna start wrapping up. And to wrap up, we always talk about our come on moments, like the things that just are like kind of eye rolling, or something like that. And then we follow it up with our favorites. So we'll go around real quick. And if you can narrow it down to one thing or theme or character or whatever, mm-hmm. we're gonna, we'll do our come on moment, and then, like I said, we'll follow it up with our favorite moments. So, Tyler, as always, like I said, you're our Skype guest, so you get to be our first on each of these. So, what was your what was the biggest thing for you? And like I said, if you need to, it can be a couple things.
I might honestly, I might need a moment. If you guys want to go ahead and go, that would okay. be great.
Griffin.
All right, so
I felt like
I'm gonna offer two, and then I'm gonna stop at that. And these are and I'm not gonna take the big ones away right off the bat, just because I don't want to be mean like that. So my very typical, like very obvious scientific thing that I just didn't get was at the beginning of the movie they need like a full 3-stage rocket to get off the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on in the movie, they're on a planet that has 130% the gravity, but they just take off like a shot out of there, and get right back to the place where they need to get out of there.
They Star Wars it.
They Star Wars it out of there, man. They hyperdrive and they are gone. And so I was just like, what? That can't possibly be how that works. If you just told me that it works a different way earlier. And then my other major issue with it, and I think I've already harped on this a little bit, but I feel like if you don't cast someone super perfect for that role, Cooper he does not matter. Like it's a character that like no one connects with. The script does not get me to connect with that character. Mm. And so I think that this morning I was talking to my roommates and I was like, we went and saw it last night. One of them had some like really emotional response to the movie. She really enjoyed it. The other one was kind of like, yeah, didn't really connect with anybody. And so I was like, why did you connect with Cooper at all? And she, her kind of thought was like, well, he's like a father. And I appreciated the fact that that he cared about his daughter and he cared about them. And I was like, but then he didn't go after her. Like then he left. Like then he had the chance to be with her and he peaced.
Yeah.
And so I just felt like so much of that character and like this is like the main thrust of the movie is this guy and like kind of what he's dealing with is, I guess, what you would assume the main character would be like a big important piece. And mm-hmm. it did not feel like there was time and like it didn't feel like there was a lot of time put into like how do we make this character believable?
Yeah.
And make him someone that's an obvious like father figure. I don't know. No. So I think that's.
But I mean, we've talked about that.
Yeah, yeah. So I think to say that, that's my biggest issue with it.
Yeah. If I had to hear that pull one more time, I was gonna throw my shoe at the screen, and it was like on the
Did he? I wonder if he was like saying it to her after every single at the end of every single message to his daughter. He was like at the end of every single one, and eventually she was just like, and cut it off.
Cut this message off here. Man, so they're just kind of this overall heavy-handed conceit about how important this movie was. It's like the filmmakers, made it feel like that they thought it was super important, and throwing all this like heavy-handed melodrama, and the script itself, just the dialogue was so thin that any kind of scene that could have had a lot of weight to it, for instance, between Murphy and her brother, about the whole fields and needing to get out of the house and that kind of thing, could have had a lot more weight to it and been, it was handled as best I think it could have by the actors, but just a lot of the dialogue and the heavy-handedness of the film was just a lot of eye-rolling moments for me. So that was my come on, man. And actually, just from a filmmaking standpoint, I really hated the final visual of the movie. Because the first visual I liked with the bookshelf and the dust falling onto the NASA toy mm-hmm. spaceship, but the final visual was Anne Hathaway walking back towards her base, and that was when it cut to black, when it should have been, you know, Cooper in his ship going out into the stars, you know, because that would have been much more metaphorical of like he's in his ship, not the ship that was, you know, when the spaceship's not dusty and on the bookshelf anymore. It's out in space, and that should just final picture should have been space. That should have been, but
the final frontier.
They switched just, you know, like him descending out into space and her on the. But that's just a that's a filmmaking thing for me. But I was disappointed with that.
Tyler, you good yet?
Yeah, I think so. I tend not to, only occasionally in movies do I have an oh come on moment. Usually it's just a sort of a perpetual, just kind of a what, just that kind of thing. And I think I probably had that with a couple of things. Number one was just how, okay, so there's something that we talk about on More Than One Lesson. It's a thing that I, it's a phrase that I came up with. It's pretty exciting.
Patented.
And nobody cares. Yeah. Yeah. And I feel stupid for saying it, but it actually has turned out to be a pretty effective shorthand. It's what I call Aaron Brockovich syndrome, in which the other characters have, they've read the script, they realize they're not the lead, and they should just do what the main character wants and not put up any kind of resistance the way people do. And this seems to have Aaron Brockovich syndrome in a certain way, which is everything is built around Cooper. Everything. Like, mm-hmm. even to the extent that the secret NASA headquarters are near him. Yeah. Isn't that, I mean...
convenient?
Wouldn't it have been... It would, I'd say this. How about he drove 2 days, you know, or even just 1 day. To get to those coordinates, and it was a fun adventure mm-hmm. he was going on with his daughter. Then it's like, okay, so they had to drive quite a ways to get where they were going, but I got the impression it was like 15 minutes away. Yeah, so just everything, and then, you know, Cooper and his daughter being the thing that saves humanity and all that, but whatever, anyway. And the other one, I have no problem with Topher Grace as an actor. I think he and I have no problem with his performance. The thing that got me was like, why am I looking at Topher Grace all of a sudden? Where did he come from, and why is he here? Did he wander in? Like, again, I think he's a very good actor in the right role, It's not like this is not the right role. It's just nothing. It's nothing.
Yeah, I was like, was that a role? Like, was something supposed to happen?
Yeah.
It looks like he stumbled in off the street in a suit and tie. He's like, you guys need another person in this just anywhere?
Yeah, just stand over there. That's good.
It's like they decided to take the stage directions and turn them into a character. and again, that's not his fault. But right. just the way he is revealed, it was... jarring to me, and I just, because that's the thing, Matt Damon is a reveal, like mm-hmm. We've heard about the character, we've heard that he's the best and all that kind of thing, and then out comes Matt Damon, and it's, you know, so I'm okay with that, whereas there's Topher Grace, what? It's just that's
funny, because the first time you see him is, he's like, he's been waiting for you, whenever she comes into the hospital, that's the first time you see him in the entire movie,
yeah.
And it's like, why does why is Topher Grace working in a hospital?
Why wouldn't he be?
He was with her, I mean, throughout the...
Yeah. Yeah, I get the impression that maybe he's the one that she winds up marrying. I don't know.
Yeah. No, he was there. He was, you know, outside, like, the fields were burning, and he's like, come on, you know, we need to go, you know, he's coming, and then...
No, the first time you see him is she walks into the hospital to see Dr. Brand.
Oh, yeah.
And he's like, he's been waiting for you, and I'm why does Topher Grace work in this hospital?
Yeah.
Why didn't they just hire a random guy off the street to work in the hospital?
Yeah.
Well, it's because, you know, in the future, actors are doctors.
Oh.
Well, they don't need actors anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So you said... that, oh, come on, we will also talk about some things that we did like.
The good moments.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. We'll hit that next.
Okay.
Is that good for your come on moments?
I think that's it, yeah. And again, like, neither of them were a huge reaction. It was more just like, oh, what? Just that.
Well, I'll make mine real quick then so we can leave on a positive note with our favorite moments. I'm basically going to paraphrase J.R. Forresteros in his review of Interstellar. by saying that Tars should not be the most likable character in a film about the triumph of the human spirit.
Yeah.
So that was my biggest thing.
Yeah.
I mean, because when I think back of like all the great lines and the funny things and the great interactions, Tars was basically all his interactions were the best. The machine thing. So that's unfortunate.
At first, I hated the design of like mm-hmm. I was like, hold on.
And then he just like leaned forward.
And then and even as the movie went along, I was like, why am I watching like 2001: A Space Odyssey again or Disney's The Black Hole? But then I was like, oh, it's kind of lovable.
It's got some versatility.
It's kind of lovable that he's just like kind of do whatever.
So yeah, mine parrots off a lot of what Griffin had said. You know, it was cool that Tars was really likable, but honestly, like in a movie about the human spirit and love and emotion, why is a robot the thing that I connect with most?
Yeah, absolutely.
Again, I'm a computer. You know, things like that. All right, so we're ending positively. Okay. So.
Tyler, are you guys referencing those G.I. Joe things?
Yes, we were.
Just making sure.
That's right.
I haven't seen those in many years, but I immediately thought, hey, wait a second, that sounds familiar.
That sounds great. Okay, so favorite moment, Tyler?
I tell you, there's a bunch. You know, that's the thing. Okay. As much as we might harp on this film, there's a lot of things I liked. I did like Tars. I like that it was voiced by actor Bill Irwin, who is an actor that is underused but is used wonderfully in Rachel Getting Married, playing Anne Hathaway's mm-hmm. father. I think he's a very good actor, and I think he did a really great job because the for lack of a better term, humanity of that character has to vary based on his settings at any particular moment, and so I like that a lot. Mm-hmm. I like him. I do love when Matt Damon comes out of that chamber and just bursts out crying. I mean, that is a mm-hmm. very real and raw moment. And you don't get a lot of those in this film, except when you get the transmission from Jessica Chastain when she hasn't given one before, and it's because she is now her father's age. That's really powerful. I do like the other planets. I like that there's just a water planet. I like having to deal with those waves and that this is what this planet is. It is completely – it has the things we need, but it's completely uninhabitable. But then I also mm-hmm. like the ice planet and the idea of the frozen clouds and the way that is revealed, that they happen to just clip one a little bit. I thought the score was great. A few years ago, Hans Zimmer started doing interesting work again. Like for a while, I just kind of felt you knew what you were getting with him. And then something happened. Like he churns out this really amazing Sherlock Holmes score. And then the stuff he's been doing with Christopher Nolan has been great. So, and this is no exception. I liked it a lot. Matthew McConaughey does a really wonderful job being the anchor that I was talking about. And yeah, and I think it does the spectacle really well. Seeing planets and black holes and just these really beautiful images, and it's directed with just such a sure hand. And it's not self-conscious, nor is it like, hey, everybody, look at what we're doing. It's not that either. So, again, there's so many – I think this film is a good candidate for a term that is thrown around pretty regularly, which is the idea of something being the sum of its parts and something being more than or less than. I think this movie is less than the sum of its parts. Individually, taken individually, there's a lot of wonderful things about this film. Add them up, and they don't quite measure up to a movie that I loved, but it was still a movie that mm-hmm. I admired, that I respected. I really, from a plot standpoint, I did not expect them to do that time manipulation thing, but I loved it. I loved that they did. Mm-hmm. The idea that you lose an hour here and you lose 7 years elsewhere, and the idea that the character, I think his name's Romilly, and that he says, okay, I'll stay back on the station and I'll research the black hole. And I remember just instinctively thinking, well, how much research is going to get done? And then I realized, oh, right, years worth of research. Mm-hmm. And then when they see him and he looks like a hollowed out shell because he's been alone mm-hmm. for 23 years, occasionally sleeping, of course, moments like that really add to the stakes I thought it was a really nice development. And this idea, because I had actually stayed fairly spoiler-free myself, and I had no idea that Jessica Chastain was going to be his daughter. I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. And so that was a nice reveal. And yeah, it's just, again, there's a lot of things that I really, not merely like, there are a lot of things I loved about this movie. I just felt that they weren't quite added up exactly the way that I would have liked.
No, I think that's completely fair. And I don't think you're going to find a lot of arguments on a lot of those fronts.
Nope. Yep. Absolutely.
Actually, well, I wanted to say something about that real quick. Sorry, Griffin. Because it's one of the things that I've been telling people as well with this movie. Like, I loved all these individual little pieces. And I think it would have come together better if it was like an 8 or 10 episode miniseries on like HBO. So that like one episode we could have gotten them to go and really explore going to the water planet.
Yeah.
And the decisions that would have had to been made and talked about before going, like the trials, getting there and getting off, and then dealing with the consequences of coming back 23 years later. But instead we got like 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted this to be like True Detective meets Cosmos or something. Just 10 episodes of,
yeah,
awesome.
Yeah, much better as a miniseries. Let's go, Griff.
Definitely go this time, Griffin.
But
there's one thing that I...
You would.
No,
you
I wouldn't. I want to know what you think.
I mean, so much... Tyler just gave so much of, like, I think the really good stuff in this movie and things that I also really enjoyed. And so thanks, Tyler, for taking all of my answers.
Sorry.
I really appreciate it. No, it's fine. Opinion, you do you, man.
I'm of the opinion that if there's anything I feel like I should say, that I should, that I will say it no matter what. If I'm thinking it, why shouldn't I say it?
I'm pretty sure that's Tyler's law.
That's my, yeah. Incidentally,
I appreciate
real quick, you said Tyler's law. Sorry, you said Tyler's law, which got me thinking about Murphy's law, which got me thinking about Murph. Which made me realize, like, there are moments when he's yelling out Murph, and I was like, Murph's a weird word to yell. This is actually taking me out of the emotion to hear him yell Murph.
Murph! 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 Make him stay, Murph!
It sounds silly. It's a silly word, Murph. Anyway, that was it. Sorry.
Agreed. All in favor of agreeing that's a weird word
that's
to yell?
That's an odd word.
Aye.
Yeah, eyes have it. Yeah, I mean, honestly, my favorite thing about this movie was still McConaughey. I got done, and I totally agree with, again, JR. It's like you're here in spirit always. But with JR's thing where he was like, I just want Matthew McConaughey to call me slick one day. Like, that's like a bucket list thing. Because it's just, I don't know, he's just, I don't know what happened in the last year and a half, but, like, he just became, like, a really great, like, I mean... He was great on U571. Was that what it was?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. He was great in that. And I remember seeing that and being like, oh, okay. He's not just that guy from How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. All right. But then I think, you know, as I saw Dallas Buyers Club, as I saw True Detective, as like the 5 minutes that he was around for Wolf of Wall Street, I was like, man, this guy has got it.
Did you see Magic Mike?
I did not, actually.
He's great in that.
He's great in that.
Okay, I'll have to check that one out. So, yeah. In all seriousness, I've heard enough people say it was good. It's just hasn't been funneling to the bottom of the list of things that I need to see.
It's marketed correctly for people to see it, but it's not the movie that's marketed.
Yeah. So, I mean, I honestly, like, if there is a shining moment, I mean, if there is a reason that I would ever watch it again, it's because of him. And I feel like he does such a good job. Once again, I'm just getting a character across to me that I don't connect with, that I don't understand off the bat. But once he gets into the role, I'm like, oh, I kind of get where this guy's coming from because you play him really well. And I also, I mean, I was happily surprised by a 10-year-old girl. I mean, like Mackenzie Foy. Yes, the girl who played Murphy as a young child. Man, that was an incredible performance by her to be as young as she is. Mm-hmm. So,
I mean, I love Matthew McConaughey. You know, it's like I said this to Griffin yesterday, but it's like the year 2013 said, you know what we need more of? Matthew McConaughey driving in a car, being super emotional and giving a monologue, and 2014 was like, yes, I will give you that. And so we have the Lincoln car commercial and True Detective and Interstellar. So I really liked him. I thought the best part of the movie was TARS, the robots, which is odd in a movie that's about humanity. But then I really loved, you know, the visuals are just amazing. I really loved one specific visual, and that was the first time that we see the black hole. It's very, very tiny. And it looks like if you were seeing a black hole approaching from far away, it gave me this sense of realism. And
wait,
like,
the black hole or the wormhole? The sphere?
Yeah.
Or the big black thing with the ring?
No, not the big black thing with the ring.
Sphere. Yeah, the sphere.
On our side of the galaxy, wormhole, the wormhole.
Yeah. The black hole was gargantua or whatever.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah. So the wormhole, seeing it from that far away, when mm-hmm. it was just a really tiny, and it was like you were getting that sense of excitement that they were getting, you know, mm-hmm. of like, that's it. That's the, can you see it?
You like,
know,
can you stop the spinning? He's like, can you stop the spinning now? He's like, why? Because we can see it?
Yeah.
Like, he's like, can you stop this so that I can see what it looks
I thought
like?
That visual was really important and really well done. And then they finally get there, and I loved them going through it. It was just mm-hmm. inventive and different and something you haven't seen. If I got the, you know, the big nature of this film and the kind of gargantuan, you mm-hmm. know, idea that they were going for with this wormhole, black hole kind of thing. So, you know, it's really cool.
So let me just drop a ditto
yeah.
right there for all, yeah, whatever. but I wanted to say that, yeah, probably if there was a reason I went back and watched this, it's because I think that TARS got all the best lines.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
just those interactions with Cooper and TARS.
Humor 75%.
Yeah.
75%.
Self-destruct sequence.
In 10, 9,
make that 65.
65.
Knock, knock.
Knock, knock.
Yeah. I mean, just, you know. You make it I mean, like, okay, so there's been some complaints about the score being too loud, the music being too loud, that you can't hear a lot of the... yeah, I mean, it's a... And I honestly couldn't hear what they were saying a lot of times, and I noticed that people with me didn't catch some of the lines, because apparently I was the only one that caught when TARS actually said, is everybody good? Plenty of slaves for my robot army?
Oh,
the
I
colony?
Love that line.
Yeah. That was great.
I feel like they gave all the best line to TARS. And like, there was this one point, or I know I was the only person, because I had it explained to everybody who went to see the movie with me, where he said, I have a cue light to show you when I'm joking. And then later in the film, when he's talking about, like, going into the black hole and being able to sacrifice himself, and, like, you know, the Matthew McConaughey, he's like, hey, I didn't catch that light. And, like, he put it on, you know, because, like, showing that, like, he's not yeah. joking, you yeah, know, yeah. like, it was... I thought it made TARS the most human character
absolutely.
In the movie.
It really did.
And so, unfortunately, it wasn't about robots becoming. You know, this isn't like Chappie. You know, so
I would never leave you behind, Dr. Brand.
yeah. Well, and it's like, and like that whole thing when you know, Cooper's leaving and he says, you know, what is your trust setting, TARS? And he says, lower than yours, apparently.
Yeah.
yeah. It's just, I don't know, it was so great. Like I said, I wish TARS could have been a person so that yeah. I could have had more, I could have said that there was more connection in the movie.
Yeah,
but
I
like,
think like the most biting line that was made outside of him was that one line that Dr. Brand made where they're about to get in the sleep capsules, and she's like, we agreed on 90%.
Oh, yeah.
Whenever he's like, it's the best of us on this plane, on the ship, right? And she's like, we agreed on 90%.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, there's that, like, and the visuals. I think the visuals are obviously pretty spectacular. When it's not just two people talking in a room for extended periods of time, explaining things, the actual space visuals are pretty cool. And I think well worth your time. But as we wrap up, I want to thank all the guests for being here by allowing them to tell you, the listener, where you can get a hold of them, keep the conversation going, and stuff like that. So, Tyler, thanks so much for being here. How can people follow the work that you do on whatever medium you so choose to let them know about?
Well, I'd say primarily a podcaster. I occasionally write articles and that sort of thing, but you can follow my podcast, Battleship Pretension, which is available every week, and that is a show in which we don't necessarily review movies. We talk a lot about movies, but that's more topic-based, and lately, like in the last year, the topics have gotten somewhat academic, like a recent one is inevitability, which is to say... I have no real interest in seeing the new Hobbit movie, but of course I'm going to see it. You know what I mean?
Same here.
And I said about Interstellar, I didn't have a lot of interest in it, but of course I'm going to see it. It just and why that instinct comes into play with film fans. Like, is it just about wanting to be part of the conversation, or what is it? So
it's destiny. Or do that, you hear that, Mr. Anderson? That is the sound of inevitability.
That's a spot on Hugo Weaving.
Oh, thank you.
I wish there was a humor light because I was being sarcastic. but yeah, so
that on the other end was funny. Yeah.
So you can find Battleship, obviously BattleshipPretension.com, and then my other show, which is Battleship Pretension, is not a Christian show, except for, you know, me. But then my other show, More Than One Lesson, that is a Christian show in which we talk about movies, newish movies, from a Christian perspective, but also from an artistic one. And so, I'll say this: we've been having a little bit of problem with our RSS feed. We recently migrated it onto a new host, and iTunes is taking forever to recognize that. But the episodes are still in the feed. You can still subscribe to the feed if you go through our website to do so. You can even get it into iTunes if you go through our website to do so, but you can't necessarily update it on iTunes specifically. So the most recent episode, according to iTunes, is about The Conjuring, but since then we recently did a live show at Biola University talking about Guardians of the Galaxy, and then we are doing a mini-sode series about the best pictures, and we did an episode about Forrest Gump. So you can find that and a lot of other stuff at morethanonelesson.com.
Cool. Griffin,
I don't want to talk about it.
You cannot get a hold of Griffin.
You cannot find me anywhere. You can find me on Twitter at Griffin_Kale. I have a website, griffinkale.com, where I don't currently post much.
So if you like not reading things,
yeah,
go to griffinkale.com.
Go to griffinkale.com. Thanks for stopping by. Soon there will be material because my job has changed enough that I can do that at work, which is great. And it's been approved. but it is something that I'm working on. So, yeah, other than that, you can find me in those places. I'm also on this show fairly regularly. And very soon, there will be a series coming out from me on the website.
Wait, on my website?
On the website. That's
okay.
What I said. Yeah, right. Your website, yeah.
Me?
Sure.
My next?
Mr. Mark.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Mark Wingdinger. As always, I say I'm a script writer, so I write a lot where you can't read it because it's behind the scenes. But I do write occasionally for Real World Theology, and I'm on here occasionally, and I'm on Whoology every once in a while, which is another good podcast by Real World Theology and Mr. Fizz here. Do check out. We're about to wrap up the season. If you're a big Doctor Who fan, make sure you check that out. But yeah, that's where I am currently.
Cool. And if you want to follow me, you can follow me at Fizzification on Twitter, or you can follow the show, Real World Theology, at Real World Theo. If you'd like to know more about the show, then please go to realworldtheology.com. That's R-E-E-L, worldtheology.com. Connect with us on Facebook, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. And if you enjoy it, heck, review the show. Let us know what you think. Let's get more people involved in the conversation. It's always more fun when we're engaging lots and lots of people. So again, I just want to thank Griffin, Mark,
yeah,
and Tyler for being here.
Oh, thank you.
Especially Tyler.
Thank you for having me.
For getting up so early. Yep. And if we're lucky, maybe some other time in the future.
Sure, absolutely.
I do want to thank the listeners for taking time to make us part of your week. And until next episode, remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye-bye.
To find out more, or to hear about other podcasts that engage faith and pop culture, please go to www.crossovernexus.com.